Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Republican Karen Handel has won the special election in Georgia. The Democratic Party establishment has been expecting big electoral victories due to Trump's unpopularity, but this is not materializing. In a dramatic shakeup, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has been ousted and been replaced by King Salman's 31-year-old son, who has played a central role in the kingdom's genocidal war against Yemen. Theresa May has laid out her government's proposed laws in the annual Queen's speech, but as protests swell in the streets in the aftermath of the Grenfell fire, are her days as prime minister numbered? But first, we turn to the special election in Georgia. We are joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa, the host of the weekly show The Way with Anoa and deputy director of MPACT. Welcome back, Anoa.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for joining. Yesterday's election in Georgia's 6th congressional district was the most expensive in history. Karen Handel, the Republican, won the election despite the Democrat John Ossoff raising around $25 million. This is, of course, just one of 435 House seats. But do you think it had greater symbolic or perhaps strategic significance?
No, and that is something that has always was kind of boggling from when it was first announced, like kind of that this was the race focusing on. And you know, obviously, you know, people have said that Tom Price vacated the seat to take his position in the Trump administration. But if that were, we've seen other seats vacated by people now in the Trump administration that did not get the same level of attention and support. I mean, we also yesterday had the special election in the South Carolina 5th congressional district, which actually, you know, the turnout and the breakdown in terms of, you know, the percentages actually was about the same with no investment, no money, just a lot of, you know, blood and sweat and grit on the ground. So, looking at this calculus, I'm not really sure what the BCCC, the DNC, and other party leaders are actually doing and what their priorities are, but it's really not panning out. I mean, John Ossoff was a hand-picked, hand-chosen candidate. He had Hank Johnson and John Lewis, two Vanguard elders of the party, to vouch for him and say, this is the guy. It was a jungle primary. In the primary, there were several Democrats that ran, you know, folks who were well-respected and actually qualified in this district who did not even get a look or consideration to see if, you know, that could be someone that could be viable to pull voters together in the 6th district here. And it was just told off that there was never a comprehensive, cohesive message. I mean, he struggled a lot, similar to Hillary Clinton's campaign leading into the November election. And a lot of the same errors were made, the same calculus was being used as, you know, after winning the primary and trying to swing right to get those moderate Republicans, pick up Republican voters, instead of really trying to mobilize and activate those voters who actually are there in the district that would turn out for a candidate other than the Republican Karen Handel. That just did not happen from the campaign and the party standpoint. The grassroots effort is a whole other story, and that is not really being shared anywhere. There are a lot of amazing people here, whether they're Bernie-crats or Hillary supporters, really came together and seen the unity on the ground with grassroots people on their own organizing. It's been amazing, and I really hope people can keep up the momentum.
I hear you about that. I mean, there was articles early on in this campaign in the New York Times up here. I'm in Washington, D.C., so you're in Georgia. The race was in Georgia. There were articles about these women. It was mainly women who had come together and who were becoming political activists for the first time. This is a conservative area, but they were so upset about Trump and so upset about the right-wing, anti-immigrant, racist, misogynist policies of Trump that they became active. Then this seat opened up because the former seat holder went into the Trump administration. So, yeah, you have a situation where the grassroots in areas that were politically just completely dominated by conservative politics want to do something. They want to do something. But the something that the Democratic Party is giving them and the candidates who they're fielding, who the Democratic Party elites say, you can't really be a leftist. You really can't be a Bernie Sanders type liberal or even to the further to the left. You can't say support single payer health plan. That's too far gone. That's off the table. So we have centrist candidates, and I would say it seemed to me that Ossoff was really ran as a centrist, as you're, I think, suggesting, and yet losing again. I mean, the Democratic Party somehow managed to lose the presidential election against the most unpopular candidate in American history. That would be Donald Trump. So they've applied the same method and the same thinking now again going forward. In other words, a lot of people would think Donald Trump, because his approval rating is so bad, it's so low at this stage in his time in office, new to office, that the Democrats must be able to do better in 2018. But if this is any indication, the Democratic leadership is not able to really turn the situation around.
Well, you know, this is just set back to just one point, grassroots point, like the newer, you know, suburban housewives, the suburban white women type of thing. I don't really have any measurements or understand how that has factored into this race. I know part of my understanding is a lot of the on-the-ground work in terms of canvassing and stuff were folks who were coming from other parts, not just in the district. And there were a lot of black and brown folks who were canvassing, who had issues in terms of police getting called on them. One of the leaders of the DeKalb County Young Dems actually had an encounter with racial profiling while he was canvassing about 2 weeks ago. There was a lot that happened and went down this campaign. But when I'm talking about grassroots, I mean like your DSA folks, you know, your Democratic Socialists of America folks, your Our Revolution folks, because there's a lot of trashing of the Bernie bros as to why, as one of the reasons being used to why Ossoff did not win. But these are people who came from out that don't live in the 6th District. People down here in the metro, you got to understand the metro Atlanta area, we have like a lot of metro areas, we have several different congressional districts that cover our area. I live in John Lewis, District of 5th. So a lot of folks came from the 5th District and went up into the 6th to help canvass. People came from the northern part of Georgia down to come help canvass because they just did not have enough people to help canvass from inside that district itself. So I'm not sure what people did besides phone banking, but actually getting on the, pounding the pavement and getting out there in neighborhoods, you had a lot of people coming from other areas to help do that. And they spent a lot of money on these ads. I mean, I was talking with several different folks, and they talk about the political consultant class and their obsession with these stupid TV commercials that absolutely mean nothing. Like, he had a commercial talking about ISIS, and every time we'll come on, again, I'm not in the district, but it's all the same TV stations, but you see the commercials, and I'm sitting here trying to understand, what are you even saying? And that was the problem. There wasn't a clear, cohesive position and message. You know, he's talking about government waste and all this other stuff, and he's trying to appeal to this rich, white, suburban population that voted overwhelmingly for Tom Price in prior elections and only nearly chose Hillary Clinton in November because of how much they did not like Trump. Now, that should have been more tied to the message. They did not tie Karen Handel nearly as enough to the unpopularity and the displeasure people have with Donald Trump as much as focusing on just trying to appeal to them on some other level. And it's a problem. And when you also think about just the way that they have empowered these people who are just pilfering and making money off of these campaigns through their kickbacks from whether it's the advertisers or whatever consultants are doing, and this awful advice that's being given, this ridiculous amount of money that's being raised to spend. Again, we had a few hours over, a few hours drive over. We also had another special election, you know, that was also a seat vacated by someone that had moved on to the Trump administration. Why was the South Carolina seat not a seat? Because you didn't have the likes of a John Lewis or a Hank Johnson to ring the banner to say, this, you need to come here and pay attention. And that is part of the problem we're seeing, though, with the way these races are being taught. You still have these select few, in some cases, you know, they're dinosaurs of a bygone age in the way politics plays out in America, making decisions and not keeping up with the very changing times. We live in a very, very different world post-2016 presidential election cycle. And the old ways of trying to do this that Democrats have been, I mean, quite honestly, you could say the Democrat way of doing things has not worked since 2010 when those seats began to be hemorrhaged and stuff. So people that are clinging to dear life to a very dying brand, a very dying way of doing things, and not being willing to listen to the quote-unquote newcomers to the party, to those people who maybe not be the traditional candidates they look for, but obviously are resonating with the people. I forget the gentleman's name, just announced that he's the Iron Stash who's running in Wisconsin's first congressional district. He's an iron worker who announced that he's running against Paul Ryan. That was an amazing, you know, piece of news to see yesterday in spite of what was happening. And it'll be interesting to see what type of support, if any, he does get. I don't know that he'll need their support, but these, there are people rising up all over who are willing to say, I'm going to take one for the team and be for the people, because obviously you guys can't do it. And we need this happening on a wave across the country. And I'm not a Dem Party gal, so it's not like I'm tied to saving the Democratic Party or anything. But I think for those people who are saying that is what their purpose is, they need to really take some really hard looks about what's happening and be honest with what the party has been doing and why it's not working, instead of just doing this blame game. I saw something blaming black voters in South Carolina for why that race is the same way. So it's like, did you invest in engaging people in outreach? Because special elections are tricky. Elections are already hard to get people out for. Special elections are tricky. And how they work and the rules and who they apply to. We have people here confused, thinking they could vote and they couldn't because they didn't understand what the district, who it applied to, because of the way, you know, the coverage has been blasted. So attention needs to be paid to these things, and there needs to be a different strategy embraced, not just in trying to, you know, get back Congress, but also looking at these state houses as we look towards 2020 and redistricting. There's a lot at stake, and it's not really panning out in a way that one would think, you know, to post-Trump resistance. I mean, the resistance is, like, looking a little limp. The only thing the resistance seems like they're really good at doing is beating up on those who are more left to them.
Your insights are fascinating and really helpful for those of us who are not there, not in Georgia, and not as close to that process. Talk about what the 6th District is and how big of an issue is racism in the 6th District in Georgia in the election process itself?
Well, racism, I mean, you know, part of the problem with this conversation was just illuminating and learning more about things like, you know, Kris Kobach and cross-check and the massive voter purging issues that have happened here in Georgia with our current Secretary of State. One thing I did learn about through just observing this process is how important Secretary of State really are. Like, everyone's complaining about systems being rigged or voters being rigged or not being able to have a paper trail with the voting machine. These are decisions and things that are made by our Secretary of State and how, depending on how your state is set up. And who sits in that seat? Who is, and Karen Handel, previously, as some may know, was Secretary of State here in Georgia and has her own issues with this stuff as well. But who sits in that seat actually can really shape or make and break the way these elections turn out. And some of the things that have been, you know, discussed in that district, it has been, you know, there was a lawsuit that was filed because of the way, I believe it was the way the voter registration deadline fell in terms of the special election, and that the voter registration deadline they were trying to enforce actually violated federal law. So they were able to get a new deadline in place. There were issues with people trying to get people to fill out absentee ballots and give them to them at the door. I mean, there is intense targeting, particularly of, you know, lower-income and minority voters, to try and dissuade them from being a part of the process. And we see this across the South. We see this, you know, in quite a few states, like Wisconsin, for example, is one place where this has been a problematic as well. But, I mean, we've seen issues in Arizona. I mean, we've seen this all sorts of places. But when we're talking about the 6th District, you know, for the most part, it's a highly educated, rich, affluent, suburban area of Atlanta proper. And you have a very insular mentality that wants to keep things, like that was even some of the language used in Karen Handel's talking points is, you know, he's not one of us. We got to keep this safe for us. And it's all like that very old kind of code language that basically, you know, appeals to white communities who are afraid of outsiders, i.e., you know, black, Latino, other immigrants, low-income people coming in and taking their stuff. And so there was this whole, there were so many layers to what happened in the 6th District. Now, can this stuff be, I personally believe that, yes, we can find a way to organize and prevail in these scenarios. I mean, I still, even though many of us have the issues we had with President Barack Obama, looking at what he was able to do to get elected in America in 2008, considering the history we have in this country, was still something that is educational in terms of how to overcome certain things. Now, would I necessarily say that we need to run candidates that do and talk and speak exactly to how he is? I just think there is an example that it's possible. Now, we can talk about that some other time, but, like, in this district, like I said, there are lawsuits there's ongoing lawsuits still in Georgia over some of the issues with our Secretary of State purging people from the rolls. There's an issue in Georgia's one of the states that if you basically if your registration goes stale, so you don't vote in a more if you didn't vote in a prior election cycle, then you're purged. So if you don't make it to vote in a primary, which some people, a lot of people don't vote in primaries for whatever reason, then you're not eligible to vote in the general election. I mean, just things like that. And that disproportionately affects, you know, Black and Latino and Asian voters. The same thing, you know, issue, you know, this isn't a state that uses cross-check that has purged, you know, thousands of voters. This is also a state with voter ID laws. There's a new organization that was just formed recently, Spread the Vote, that launched here in Georgia because of the historic nature, one, of voting rights here in the South, and particularly here in Georgia, but also because of the huge issue with people needing access to an ID to be able to vote. And beyond just needing ID to be able to vote, needing an ID to be able to exist and live. And one thing a lot of us who are of a certain age, or if you grew up in a city, you don't think about the fact that some older people don't even have access to things like an actual birth certificate. Like there may not have ever even been a birth record recorded for them. The founder of Spread the Vote was sharing a story with me, and she was just talking about how there's this older Black woman. She's either in her 60s or 70s. They're not quite sure her age. But she was born in rural Georgia, and she did not have a birth record recorded with the county of her birth. You know, in olden days, folks would have notations and Bibles and things like that. So they have to establish a later certificate of birth or delayed certificate of birth or something like that. But that requires several forms of ID. She doesn't have any ID. So to be able to establish her identity, for her to be able to not just be able to vote, but for her to get medical care, all types of stuff. So there are so many different issues that are compounded in these communities in the 6th District. While it doesn't, though it's not overwhelming like this, there are pockets, you know, within there, but this is a problem. And we saw some of that playing out in this race as well.
So the Republicans have held that district for, I think, 40 or nearly 40 years.
Approximately, nearly 40 years, yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, I guess, from a symbolic point of view, the Democrats figured, or the Democratic establishment figured, well, if you go and spend $25 million for this one House seat, and if John Ossoff would have won, that would have become like a motivator for Democrats or the Democratic base, which obviously had become pretty alienated because of Hillary Clinton's campaign. I mean, I think the main reason Donald Trump won is so many Democrats did not show up or didn't vote. I mean, some who voted for Obama in those swing states now voted for Trump because they had become just so hardened against Hillary Clinton and the Democratic establishment. But the bigger picture was about 6 million Democrats who had voted in 2008 and 2012 didn't vote this time. So I guess the thinking with the Democratic establishment was they could win. But Ossoff is now lost. When you're looking forward and you see the schism within the Democratic Party still between these elites who have failed and failed and failed and again failed to win against the most unpopular candidate, Donald Trump, ever. And you look at what's going on in 2018 and 2020, where in spite of everything, they're really not moving to the left. I'd say they're moving to the right. That's the way I see the Democratic Party. In our last minute, be a fortune teller. What do you think is going to happen?
This is going to take more of us to be engaged and involved in decision-making, what's going on at these party levels. If you are a party person and this matters to you, you have to be engaged and involved in what's going on at your state and local party level where they're making these decisions about these candidates, where they're supporting people and running people. I mean, there is a wealth of resources, information, and ideas out there about how to do this. I mean, the fact that $25 million was spent on this race by the Democrat, by Ossoff, campaign, not to mention the other money, is insane. And again, we don't even talk about the Koch money and other stuff that came in on the other side and handled breaks. But there has to be a way to break through, you know, the monopoly that money has on our political system, as well as engaging candidates. And we just have to figure out and continue to build. This is a long game. It's not going to change overnight, but we definitely need to dig in and stop the bickering so much about it and just do the work. But I really do think it's possible, and I'm looking forward to seeing several races play out. There's another race down here in Georgia, District 1, which is not going to get the support and stuff, but Lisa Ring is a great progressive candidate that's running down here. She's running as an Intel, but I'd love to see her run as an indie, but she's going to run as a Democrat, and I think there are going to be some test cases around the country. Maybe there might be smaller, glamorous districts, but I think he could turn it around.
Okay, we're out of time. We've been joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga. Try to go online and check her out. She's the host of the weekly show The Way with Anoa, and she's also the deputy director of Impact. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. In a dramatic shakeup, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has been ousted and replaced by King Salman's 31-year-old son, who has played a central role in the kingdom's genocidal war against Yemen. We are joined from London by Masoud Shajarei. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You can follow their work at ihrc.org.uk. Welcome back, Masoud.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is big news. It's big news here in Washington, D.C. and in the U.S. media, and I'm certain in the U.K. it's also big news, but not necessarily a huge shock. Tell us about the reshuffle in Saudi Arabia. The Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef has been ousted, and Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has taken his spot. Why did it happen? Why did it happen right now?
Well, I mean, you know, the reshuffle has been called. It's really, it's just a musical chair among the family, you know, that they sort of move around from one position to another position. And indeed, the royal family, they have a conflict internally. And for quite some time, King Salman wanted to sort of corner out the power into his section of the family, i.e. put his son as a crown prince. And there has been opposition within the family, but it seems that for whatever reason, those oppositions have been defeated, and he's actually managing now to sort of appoint someone for first time in the history of Saudi Arabia, someone which is actually a relatively very young man, because usually they, when they come to power, they are in sort of their old men, really. And but what is really worrying both internally and externally is the sort of the legacy that this young prince has brought with himself. As you said, the atrocities committed in Yemen under his leadership, being the head of the armed forces, and indeed the conflict within whole of the region with Qatar, with Iran. The sort of he's been even sort of the rumors that he was involved in the coup in Turkey. So he has got sort of that sort of reputation. Someone who is very ruthless, someone who is actually sort of wants to create conflict and doesn't mind how many people are going to be killed, how many children are being targeted and killed in Yemen. And it's actually very worrying for him now, not only increasing his power, but also sort of ensuring that he will be the final, sooner or later, the ruler of Saudi Arabia.
So his policies, really, when you look at Yemen, you look at the confrontation with U.S. oil producers during the oil glut, where Saudi refused to cut production targets. In other words, they wanted to keep market share and, more importantly, try to drive U.S. shale oil producers out of business. When you look at a variety of policies, most of them under this 31-year-old millennial now in line to be the king of Saudi Arabia, most of them have been big flops. I mean, real failures.
Real failure, but, you know, and very aggressive. And the reality is that if he was anywhere in the world, if indeed he was in any business, multinational business, his failure in Yemen, his failure in Syria, his failure in the economy of Saudi Arabia would have meant that he would be the last person who would be promoted into any position, let alone head of the organization, or indeed here head of the state. But then, this is a different world. When you talk about Saudi Arabia, there is very little sort of democracy or accountability of any sort, and tyranny is the word. And the reality is that with the decree, a person like that who's a failure by any standard becomes the crown prince. And this is what is really worrying. What's going to happen? Indeed, with this, what he's going to do with this increased power. The other thing is that, he has got, he has cornered his father. So he's basically gatekeeper to his father. So many of the royal family, the rumors are, that are actually excluded, even being able to contact, to have a proper contact with King Salman. So that is actually quite worrying. In many ways, it's already understood in Saudi Arabia and those who are close to the region that by de facto, he is actually the ruler. His father is extremely aged and there are some indication that he's got some sort of advanced sort of illness, including sort of loss of memory. And so in reality, he doesn't even have to wait until his father passed away. In reality, he is the ruler. And indeed, the indication that this switch into him as a future king is being said that is because of his power already within the royal family.
So let's also just have some sense for the audience of how the Saudi government works. It's obviously a monarchy. There are 15,000 members of the royal family. So whatever struggle, whatever political battles are going on within this family. I mean, it's an amazing political system. It sounds like something from, the 5th century, maybe not. Maybe the 17th century would be more like it. But in other words, an anachronistic holdover. When you look at what's going on, though, this transition also takes place at the very moment that Saudi Arabia has attempted to isolate Qatar, the crown prince, you're saying he's in essence the head of state in de facto, even though he's still an heir apparent. He was the one who met with Donald Trump. Donald Trump was then crowing about his trip. He said, now that Saudi Arabia is attacking Qatar, a worldwide terrorism was going to come to an end, and he took credit for it, of course. Then a few days later, the Trump administration announced that they're actually going to sell weapons to Qatar. Anyway, talk about his relationship now with Donald Trump, because he was, in essence, the first head of state that Donald Trump met with after becoming president.
Yes, it's a very peculiar relationship, and the fact is that it seems that deals have been already made between him and the Trump, and indeed deals have been made between him and some other regional powers. We saw the statement from Israelis welcoming this and saying that this is a sign of closer relationship, and this is not just for the energy. So really what we are seeing is a promotion of someone and is totally absolute dictator, which has got blood on his hand in Yemen and in Syria and elsewhere. Absolute dictator who is actually not shying away using any sort of unconventional way to come to power and to abuse those power. And this is actually extremely worrying. And for the listeners to understand, because sometimes we don't get the true picture of what is like in Saudi Arabia. I remember talking once to someone from high up in the court of Saudis, and I was sort of testing the water, talking about corruption. And he actually starts saying, yes, there is corruption and we need to deal with it. Then we start talking about the mayor of Mecca, who was corrupt, and he said, this is absolutely right, and he should be dealt with, and he's going to be dealt with. Then I took it to one of the members of the royal family, and I said, well, and that particular member is also very corrupt. And he said, no, that's not corruption. Everything in Saudi Arabia is owned by the royal family. So if they take anything from anywhere within the structures and the resources of the Saudi Arabia, is their own, it's not stealing. That, unfortunately, is the attitude of many people in Saudi Arabia. And when we talk about absolute rulership and absolute ownership of the whole resources and everything, that is the sort of thing, you know, one has to take into account. It really is unprecedented anywhere else, even in the Gulf regions.
I was in Saudi Arabia at the time that Muhammad Ali, the late and lamented heavyweight boxing crown, was making the Hajj. He went to Mecca and Medina. I accompanied him. I went to, of course, not being a Muslim, I didn't go into Mecca or Medina, but I was in Jeddah. And one thing that really struck me about Saudi society was the number of posters that were up on the wall with the pictures of people who were wanted by the state. And they were pictures of workers who were immigrant workers who actually, that's the bulk of the workforce there, I believe. And they were wanted because they had run away from their employer. In other words, they were really enslaved people. Their passports had been taken. They no longer, for one reason or another, perhaps abuse, perhaps because they weren't being paid properly, they didn't want to keep working for their employer. There were actually wanted posters up in the streets for these people. In other words, it's a society that is in many ways the antithesis of what we might call a democracy, or even the barest semblance of democracy. Is that right?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I really sort of try very hard to support the immigrant workers there. They are really a slave. It's systematically, when they arrive, their passport is taken. They've got no status, nothing. There are abuses of all sorts, including sexual abuses. And then, you know, you see quite a large number on accusations. They get beheaded. They get their hands chopped off. It really is no justice whatsoever. And, you know, it really is a sort of society which, if someone gets deeply involved in it, becomes almost unbelievable that such a thing could exist in today's society, and let alone be considered an ally and friend of West and United States. It really is bizarre.
What was the possible Saudi connection to the Turkey coup? Because the coup d'etat, the failed coup d'etat in July of last year, was, of course, a turning point for Erdogan, his foreign policy, certainly the souring of U.S. relations under the Obama administration and Turkey. But was there something to this allegation that this new crown prince was somehow connected to the coup in Turkey?
Well, Mr. Erdogan comes from sort of a party and a section of the Islamic sort of grouping, which is associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. He actually has made no secret of the fact that he is very close to Muslim Brotherhood. And I remember, you know, 7 years ago when I went to see him, he was actually asking how is Mr. Ghannouchi, because, you know, at that time, Mr. Ghannouchi was in UK and so forth. And he's got a tremendous respect and connection to Muslim Brotherhood. And by that definition, he is got this connection also with the Qatar, who again are sort of the only sort of section of the country within the Gulf state which are close ideologically and religiously and so forth to Muslim Brotherhood, and most senior of the Muslim Brotherhood clergy resides in Qatar and receives a lot of respect and so forth there. There is a feeling in Saudi Arabian royal family and elite that the reason that they cannot control Qatar is because of this relationship between Qatar and Turkey as a supporter of that system, supporter of Muslim Brotherhood. And so therefore, one of the ways that they could have been thinking, and this is what the sort of allegations are, is that they felt that by removing Erdogan and replacing and having a coup, then that power and that backing will be collapsing. And so therefore, Qatar will be much more amenable to sort of pressures of Saudi Arabia and has to follow the toe the line. And that was, and also that serves Egypt as well, because of Egypt, actually the greatest threat that they feel is again Muslim Brotherhood. And again, there was quite a serious bad relationship between Egypt and Erdogan because of the issue of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Masoud, let me ask you, we have about 3.5 minutes left. I want to go back to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, now has been named Crown Prince. He's the 31-year-old millennial son of the king. The king is very old, very sick. So in essence, in a de facto way, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman becomes the head of state. Now, yes, he's pursued a very aggressive policy on oil, a very aggressive warlike criminal policy in Yemen, a very aggressive policy towards Qatar. But there's also talk that this 31-year-old Crown Prince will bring reforms like the right of women finally to vote in Saudi Arabia and perhaps other sort of liberalization, social liberalization. At the same time, he's been talking about the economic program Vision 2030 that he has been overseeing. It's part of ridding the country of its complete oil dependency by diversifying the economy. So on the social question and on the economic question, is it possible that he will pursue a reform agenda?
These are all sort of rumors, but in reality, the situation of finances of the Saudi government is actually worsening by year. The amount of money they're spending in Yemen and elsewhere, and the fact that there is really no replacement, prices are going up, people are unhappy. There is really huge economical crisis. So really, he hasn't been, as much as he's been a failure in Yemen, he's also been failure when it comes to sort of rejuvenating the economy. And I think when it comes to the issue of reforming things like women's rights and so forth, I don't think he will be even touching that type of thing for a very long time, because he, if anything, at the moment, he is going to be in a much more difficult position than he has been before. Although he's been announced and that he's the future king, I think there's a huge opposition to that from the royal family and elsewhere. I think what will happen, if anything, we are going to see more of the failures in the future and bigger conflict both inside the royal family and outside the royal family. I think this decision was a very bad decision for the even people of Saudi Arabia, for the people of the region, and indeed internationally. And I think it is not going to serve anything except the interest of that particular prince and his particular bloodline.
Well, it's also very interesting that the Trump administration offered $110 billion. Of course, many of them are letters of intent, not contracts for weapons. But that's precisely the number of or the amount that the U.S. gave to Saudi Arabia during the Obama year. So it appears that whatever is happening at the top of the royal family, and again, we have a new de facto head of state with the new crown prince, the United States connection to Saudi Arabia seems to be pretty much the same. In other words, a complete alliance between the Saudi royal family, 15,000 princes, and the United States government, which calls itself the greatest democracy on the planet. We've been joined by Masoud Shajarey. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You can follow their work at ihrc.org.uk. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Theresa May has laid out her government's proposed laws in the annual Queen's speech. But as protests swell in the streets in the aftermath of the Grenfell fire, can her party survive in power for much longer? We are joined from London by Steve Headley. He is the Assistant General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, RMT. And from Kent by Jackie Walker, lifelong activist against racism and the former vice chair of the pro-Jeremy Corbyn organization Momentum. Welcome back, Steve and Jackie.
Hi.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Jackie, let's start with you. The annual Queen's Speech took place at Parliament earlier today. Tell us what the Queen's Speech is, and did this one go as planned?
What the Queen's Speech is for is really when the government of the day puts forward to Parliament and to the people the legislative program for the next year. So all the main items of policy implementation are supposed to go into the Queen's Speech, and then what happens is that there's a vote to pass the Queen's Speech. But this year, the speech was very unusual for a number of reasons. There was a bit of a hoo-ha in some of the papers because Jeremy didn't bow. In fact, it's quite all right he didn't bow, but and also because it was done in a much more informal way, it was much shorter. And what happened as a result of the election, and I have to say I'm so pleased that me and Steve were kind of right to be optimistic at the point when we last talked to you. What has happened is that Theresa May and the Tories have had to cut back their program severely. So it's a very, very unusual Queen's Speech.
Steve Headley, let's talk about that. The two of you were optimistic, and of course it was such a remarkable surge for Labour and for support for the vision of the left wing of the Labour Party, which had been counted out, certainly by Theresa May, when another gross miscalculation, just as Brexit had been a gross miscalculation. But let's talk about the Conservative manifesto that in many ways, Theresa May had to sort of walk back from in today's Queen's Speech. What was it and what wasn't there when she presented today?
Well, I mean, I think that she's tried to get through a very uncontroversial speech. The Brexit stuff that she's put through has not actually changed anything. It's imported everything into British law. The big play that they made about immigration running up to the election, they wanted to limit immigration. They've put no figure whatsoever on the amount of immigrants that they're allowed into the country. And even they've abandoned the legislation which they promised about the trade unions. They wanted to put even further restrictions on trade unions, like running minimum services during strikes on the railways. And even bills like fox hunting, which were completely unpopular, they've dropped that as well. You know, so trade unionists, immigrants, and foxes have all benefited, I think, you know, from this appalling May administration, which is now propped up by people who think that the world is 4,000 years old, the DUP, sort of fundamentalist Christian people in the north of Ireland, who support have a long record of support for loyalist paramilitaries. So that's the strong and stable government in Britain now. We're popped up by 10 headbangers from the north of Ireland who believe that I would call them dinosaurs, only they don't believe that dinosaurs exist because they believe it's a big hoax perpetrated by the scientific community.
Indeed. Climate change is a Chinese hoax. The dinosaurs are also a hoax. But we're talking there, Jackie Walker, about the Democratic Unionist Party, DUP. The Brexit negotiations began in earnest on Monday, but at the moment, is there even a UK government to do the negotiating? Because what happened to the deal between the Conservatives and the DUP? That is a very small representation from this part of the political scene inside of Northern Ireland and the reactionary pro-colonial part to boot. Talk about that. Talk about what's happening with the inability of May to form a government.
Well, they actually haven't been able to make a deal, which is extraordinary. And what's happening, you know, the DUP has a kind of history of being the kind of deal makers to enable the Tory party to remain in government. And they're very good at doing this, and they always put the stakes pretty high. And pretty high for them is wanting more money for certain bits of Northern Ireland and in terms of the structure, etc. Well, that's what people are presuming. And they will always, always ask for a lot. Now, one of the problems with how much they're asking for is if Northern Ireland gets it, Wales will want it, Scotland will want it. And remember that the Tory party, at least, is probably still clinging on to the vestiges of being an austerity party. So they haven't yet been able to come to a deal. But there's a sort of strange balance of power happening here. Because, of course, the last thing that the DUP want to see is a Labour government, a Labour government which they would feel would be more sympathetic to parties like Sinn Féin, etc. So they don't want to see a Labour government either. So they're not likely to vote against the government yet, but they haven't yet entered a formal deal. So before the election, May was talking about not voting Labour because there would be what she called a coalition of chaos. And in fact, this is what we now see with the Tories, a coalition of chaos.
Theresa May said, Steve Hadley, in the Queen's speech about the Grenfell Tower fire, that terrible, terrible fire, which impacted and killed and wounded and made homeless so many working class people and working class families. This is what Theresa May said. The support on the ground for families in the initial hours was not good enough. There was a failure of the state, local, and national to help people when they needed it most. As Prime Minister, I apologize for that failure. And as Prime Minister, I've taken responsibility for doing what we can to put things right. But this isn't just about what happened in the initial hours after fire. This is about decades of austerity and the complete disregard for the safety of housing for poor and working class people. Go ahead, talk about help our audience, especially over here, understand Grenfell Tower fire and what she means and what she didn't say.
Well, basically, what it boils down to is the Tories have blood on their hands. The Labour Party put forward a bill in Parliament very recently, which would have made landlords accountable. They have safe tenancies and recognise the rights of the tenants. They live in a safe environment. And the Tories, because they're mainly landlords, including the last Prime Minister, David Cameron, the one before Theresa May, is a landlord, and they voted against it. So they voted in their own interests and against the interests of the working class who were up in Grenfell Towers. Now, what this meant is if we have a private contractor in there who they got a contract that was worth £10 million. And because Grenfell Towers was considered a bit of an eyesore by the rich people who lived either side of it, and one of the richest boroughs, the richest borough actually, in the United Kingdom, Chelsea and Kensington, they wanted it clad. And the council clad it in materials that was flammable. If they'd have paid £5,000 more, they could have clad it in materials that was inflammable. But obviously, working class lives aren't worth £5,000. That's about $4,000, I'd imagine. So they went for the cheap option, and they burned, you know, hundreds of people probably to death. So that's Theresa May. She's crying crocodile tears. She's going to spend £5 billion, to renovate Parliament. She's going to spend £360 million to renovate Buckingham Palace, where the Queen lives. That's the unelected head of state here. They spent £10 million to create a death trap. And then they insulted all the families and the bereaved in Grenfell by offering them £5 million compensation. So it cost them £10 million to cause the fire, and they were offering £5 million compensation. Theresa May is finished. She's a joke.
Jackie, there was a mass demonstration today called by the hashtag Day of Rage, which marched from West London, the site of the Grenfell Tower fire last Wednesday, to Parliament. In terms of the overall political impact of the fire, obviously it exposes the deeper problems of conservative policy, Tory policy, as Steve mentioned, in regard to housing. But does it, will it have a major impact on what comes next from the point of view of politics?
Oh, this is major. This is absolutely major what has happened, because, you know, this is not just about housing. This is about race. And really importantly, this is about class. And it's very interesting because this links up with the Labour Party slogan of the last election, for the many, not the few. We suddenly see class coming back in as a permittable word, a concept to use when talking about politics. You know, what happened in Grenfell Towers, what's happened with austerity, what's happened with social housing, all of these things are about class, with a Tory party who have used austerity to feather the nests of their friends and their supporters, and have actually, you know, annihilated many of the services that the poorest and the dispossessed actually depend on. I mean, what you have is Grenfell Towers represents what has happened to the working classes in the last, well, more than 10 years, really. You know, and in that, I would also, by the way, and I don't know if Steve would agree with me on this, include the New Labour project, which, you know, was very happy to see people getting stinking rich on the heads of people who were being dispossessed of their homes, of their community centres. They're being squeezed with their hospital services and with education. So the real significance for me of Grenfell Towers and the march we see today is that we have class back on the agenda as a political focal point.
Steve Hedley, let's go ahead. Jump right in there.
I mean, Jackie said a lot of what I got to say, so I won't repeat it, but the point is this. I mean, working class people have been put, regardless of their race, working class people have been put in tire blocks that are flammable and that are going to burn them to death. Now, MPs in this country, they claim, a lot of them claim, second housing, allowances for second housing. So I think it's only fair that they should be put in tire blocks that are clad with these plastic bricks, because it's not just Grenfell Towers, until this housing crisis is sorted. I mean, what we have here is mass murder. There's no two ways about it. I would agree with Jackie. It was a New Labour project, and our union put its money where its mouth was. We stood against the Labour Party as part of the Trade Union Socialist Coalition until Jeremy Corbyn took power in the Labour Party. We weren't going to vote New Labour. We didn't campaign for New Labour. We fought against them because they were part of a neoliberal consensus. What Corbyn represents is something completely different. It represents the rebirth of class politics, and that's why we're behind 100% behind Jeremy Corbyn. My own personal view is, I think, and this isn't the view of my union, after stresses, my own personal views, we should be reaffiliating to the Labour Party as the RMT. They strengthen Corbyn's position in there and fight for socialist policies.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Oh, I can't agree more. I mean, this is the time. This is a time when Corbyn needs. I mean, he's strengthened. We saw his speech today. It was a speech of the leader. It was a speech of the Prime Minister in waiting. It was a speech of somebody who's the leader of a party that is waiting to govern. And that is what we want to be. But to do that properly, we also need to reform the internal workings of the Labour Party. Because as we've said a number of times before, you know, Corbyn won the leadership. What he didn't do is win the Labour Party. And there is still work to do within the structures of the Labour Party, whether it's the compliance unit or whether it's the PLP or the other governing structures of the, for example, the NEC, which has got a right-wing bias on it. And we need trade unions like the RMT to come in and rebalance that.
Jeremy Corbyn, Steve, reacted to Theresa's speech with his own talk. He said, quote, and this is what Jackie was referring to, "The latest coalition may already be in some chaos. Nothing would emphasize that chaos more than the Queen's speech we've just heard. A threadbare legislative program from a government that's lost its majority and apparently run out of ideas altogether. This would be a thin legislative program, even if it was for 1 year. But for 2 years, That's not enough in it to last 1 year. This is a government without a majority, without a mandate, without a serious legislative program, led by a prime minister who has lost her political authority and is struggling even today to stitch together a deal to stay in office. I mean, it would have been, I don't know, impossible to predict 2 months ago. I predicted something else for the 2016 U.S. election, so I've stopped making predictions officially. But it seemed impossible to think a few months ago that Jeremy Corbyn could be, as Jackie's describing, a prime minister in waiting. Is he a prime minister in waiting?
Smashed this manufactured consensus which all the mainstream media and the establishment tried so hard to do. And I have to say, there are parallels in the States from a completely different opposite of the spectrum. The establishment and the mainstream media were completely Hillary Clinton. I think that was a massive mistake. They should have backed Bernie Sanders. But what happened here is people just rebelled against that. And mainstream media is no longer believed. And I have to say, right, when you're going into coalition to get even a threadbare pieces of legislation like this with climate change deniers, with people who hate Roman Catholics, with people who want to march during nationalist areas with loyalist bands to stir up discontent, with people with links with loyalist paramilitaries, with people who believe in creationism. This is not a good place to be for Theresa May. And I think that she's lost all authority. And I believe that Jeremy Corbyn is now seen, and the opinion polls reflect this, that Jeremy Corbyn is now seen as he smashed through this glass ceiling, if you like, that has been manufactured, which said he's unelectable. He's now eminently electable. Everybody knows this. And whichever dirty deal they do, they better be aware of this. They will not be marching down the Gavahi Road, because that's what these loyalists want. They want to march through nationalist areas, and they want to march through with their triumphalist parades, their supremacist parades, and whatever dirty deal they come to with me. There's more law in the land than the police and the army over there. They will not be marching down the Gavahi Road.
Jackie Walker, the Brexit negotiations have begun in earnest. We have about 2 minutes left now. Under these circumstances, the destabilization or apparent inability for Theresa May to form a government right now, again, the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, its left wing, having surprised all with this magnificent, remarkable showing in waiting, what's its impact on the Brexit negotiations? Can there be any real negotiations?
Well, there has to be some kind of negotiation, even if it's just a show of negotiations. I mean, what will happen is, I think a hard Brexit has now become an impossibility. But I mean, all of this is trouble yet to come for Theresa May. I mean, this is only the start. I mean, it's going to be extraordinary to see how she's going to manage Brexit, because the issue of Europe is one that totally divides the Tory party, and she's going to have trouble keeping the Tory party together, let alone the country on this.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from London by Steve Headley. He is the Assistant General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, RMT. And from Kent by Jacqueline Walker, lifelong activist against racism and the former vice chair of the pro-Jeremy Corbyn organization Momentum. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.